Hey, everybody. Just a little bit about this episode and the episodes to follow that are from the International Conference on the Fantastic and the Arts, or ICFA. These were done in a hotel room, and I made the stupid mistake and left my recorder at home, so that means that the audio quality is not bad. It just has a little bit, I guess I'd call it like a cavernous feel. I cleaned it up as best I could. It's generally listenable and fine. It's not like crappy. It's just, you'll notice that the audio is just different. So that's that. The other thing I did want to mention is this is the last month for the Worldcon fundraiser. We have, as of the time this episode will go up, 27 days left. The fundraiser closes on the 28th of April. And that means we really, really need your support to make this happen. We are going to be doing a lot of stuff at Worldcon, programming stuff, interviews, discussion episodes, talking to international authors, doing a lot. And, you know, this ICFA stuff is really sort of a taste of just really this, like a tiny taste of what we'll be up to at Worldcon. So any little bit you can help, you know, with $5 or whatever will be really great, but we really need a push to get this to happen. So we really need your support. And otherwise, I do thank you for listening and for supporting us. And if you voted for us for Hugo, I'll probably do an internet hug. So on that note, I'm going to shut up and get to the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But Ducrell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skipping and Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest today is Fran Wild.
Hello!
Hello!
So first off, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Tell you a little bit about Fran.
Okay, well, we'll start there.
I've had the privilege of hanging out with Fran several times before, and I know a little bit about her work. So Fran writes short stories and poetry. Has a novel that is going to come out with a tour. It's actually a three-book series, I think.
Oh, super.
Yeah, and then she's also... One of the things that I really love that Fran does is this blog series called Cooking the Books.
Saw that.
Okay, so that's, I think, the first thing I think you should tell us about Cooking the Books. How did you start it? What is it? And more about it.
That's a great question. Cooking the Books started at Viable Paradise, which is a one-week workshop in the fall in Martha's Vineyard. And Stephen Gould and I had been talking about writing and stuff and cooking and ridiculous recipes. And I brought up the fact that I have an expat sort of State Department cookbook within the back has ridiculous recipes in it, like how to cook a cobra. And the first step of that recipe is first catch cobra. there is a recipe about how to cook stuffed camel, which is, you know, you get lots of, it's like a turducken, but it's with a camel. And then the last recipe in the book is a pretty well-known one. It's called elephant stew. And the first step of elephant stew is first cut elephant into bite-sized pieces. As you may imagine, that's probably a little bit harder than your average stew recipe. Yeah. And we were talking about this and we were laughing because, and he said, well, that sounds like how to write a novel. And I said, yeah, you know, that's a great idea. Would you like to, because I was looking for ways to talk to people, and I am, people who know I'm loud and I can be pretty boisterous, but I'm also very shy, especially with people that I admire or people that I have perceived as very kind, but I don't know very well. So part of my goal was to find a way to talk with people about their work and about their craft, and to also do one thing a month that I was afraid of doing. So my challenge to myself had been, when I left VP, I was going to find something that I could do that would make me address some of those things. Talking to strangers, talking to people I admire, and using some of my skill set, which is I used to do a lot of interviews for engineering magazines and like engineering schools and clients and chemists and lots of different science writing things. So I'm used to interviewing people. And I knew I could do that part. I knew I could transcribe an interview. I didn't know if I could interview an author. I wanted to try, and Stephen Gould was my first victim. And his interview is on how to cook an elephant or how to write a novel. And it was the first interview, I think in November of 2011. And then the next, pretty soon after that, my friend Greg Frost agreed to do an interview, and Elizabeth Baer agreed to do an interview.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't get into the every month schedule until a couple months later. And then a friend had asked me if I was interested in, at some point, talking to a couple of their friends, and it just got to be word of mouth. If I interviewed somebody, they'd say, oh, well, you need to do this person or this person. And there was one point where I had a couple of people that I all wanted to interview, and I thought, well, why don't we do it as a round table? And a friend then suggested contacting Strange Horizons and sending a round table to them. And I quick got everybody together and interviewed them over Skype. And that roundtable turned out to be one of the most hilarious, grossest things that happened to me that year. We talked about some crazy things. But I've talked with just amazing people. Aliette de Baudard's conversation about Asian cooking and Vietnamese and French food. But we also talked about things that weren't food-related. We talked about cultural appropriation. And we talked about food in various cultures and how that feeds into a book and how that sort of steadies the world building in a book. Stephen Bruce talked about how his character was kind of a pantser in the kitchen, much like, you know, and his novel writing has a similar flair to it. So it's often about food, but it's also about something else too. And it's just been amazing to talk to all the different authors that I've had the opportunity to talk to, and I'm looking forward to talking to many, many more, because everybody has a different thing to say, and everyone's a different kind of cook, too, or a different kind of food lover. Like the most recent ones were David Edison. He was talking about sandwiches. And if you haven't heard the sandwich or read the Sandwich Manifesto, it's totally worth it. and Russ Galen, my agent, came in and talked about how being an agent is kind of like a tapas restaurant. You can go in and sample lots of different things. And he was very, very obsessed with his time when he gave this interview, and it's one of my favorites. They're all my favorites, but most recent favorite, because he talked about how it just needs to be a good story. Like he's willing to read anything as long as it's a good story. I think that's really important. But he made it into a food analogy, and I'm like, Coming up, we have some really exciting ones. We've got Merle Lafferty.
Oh, okay.
Because she's got that great new book, Ghost Train to New Orleans.
Yep, the second one in her...
Shambling Guides.
There you go.
The second one in her Shambling Guides books, and that's going to be fabulous. We have Mike Underwood is going to come in and talk about pizza.
He's one of our people.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Mike is a Skiffy and Panty regular.
He was assimilated into the collective.
Well, I am sort of looking for a way to break Cooking the Books into podcasting at some point, because some of the people really should not be in text. They should be on. I mean, Scott Lynch is not... You can't get the full Scott Lynch effect unless you hear his voice say, you know, Kazu Marzu, the Cthulhu of cheese. That is... and I think... You know, it's fascinating. But Mike's going to be on. He's going to be fantastic. We're going to have Beth Cato, who's Clockwork...
Heart? Clockwork Heart?
No.
Clockwork Dagger?
Clockwork Dagger, yes.
It's like Clockwork
something object.
Please make sure we get that right, or cut it, or cut it.
We can, yeah, we'll check. But it's a steampunk book that's coming out
from HarperCollins.
Yes.
So that's going to be great. I've got a bunch of other people that I want to interview, and I think I'm going to ask someone to do a couple of guest interviews as well, and then I'm going to need somebody to hopefully interview me at some point.
Hint, hint.
So,
wink, wink.
So we are actually interviewing you right now.
Yes.
And you have actually just gotten this amazing book deal. Tell us a little bit about your books and also about what kinds of food you've written into your own world.
Well, that's a good question.
Getting hungry now.
Well, Bone Arrow is a particularly interesting community for food, because they are a city of living bone that has risen far above the clouds. And this is a culture that is convinced that down is bad, and not just bad, it's dangerous.
Interesting.
And they have sort of lost everything as they passed through the clouds. They lost a lot of their history and their culture. There are things in the clouds that are extremely dangerous. They are not wrong about this. And the higher you go, the safer you are. And the towers keep rising, and the central core of the towers expands out as the towers grow up. So you're actually pushed as a community up higher. As you can imagine, the sustainability of an ecosystem in this situation is delicate at best. They have birds. They have some high-altitude things. Like they have been beekeeping. They managed to preserve some and bring those up. There are blackberries. And tea and things. I did some research on high altitude foods on an Earth culture. This is a secondary world, but they are, a lot of the things that they have are very much analogous to what we have for some reasons that will eventually be revealed. But there are so many things that they do not have. And because of where they're living and because of the altitude effects and things like that, it is a society that doesn't know it's surviving in a scarcity environment, but they really are. They're very careful about every little piece of things. When a predator comes, they clear off the gardens that they have growing in the tower, on the tower balconies, and they bring everything in because they can't afford to lose it.
So basically what she's saying is that they're a lot smarter than the people in Reign of Terror. Have you seen Reign of Terror?
I have not seen Reign of Terror.
So it's a dragon movie that has a science
fiction. It's not Reign of Terror.
Reign of Fire. It's a dragon movie that has a science fiction premise that the dragons are like, actually, they have a scientific explanation behind them. And
oh, like Anna McCaffrey.
So all of these dragons
not quite
come,
that good.
These dragons come and they burn everything and then they eat the ash. Because the ash is what they need to survive. And the people in this movie who have survived, like, 20 years
dragons
after
have got to have better taste than
that. 20 years after the dragons have a runner, there are a few lone holdout humans who have, like, started moving back into old castles because it's a fortified defense. And but for some reason, even though they know that the dragons burn everything and eat ash, they're like growing giant crops in greenhouses outside of the castle walls.
Oh, sure, and because that's bait.
So I was sort of like, we watched this movie to discuss it for the podcast, and I was like, I just don't understand like how they even have tomatoes at this point at all. So I'm glad to hear that your people at least, like, know enough to bring this stuff inside.
They almost lost everything. They have a group of people who worked very hard to preserve what they could. So they did do some things where they preserved seeds and they preserved some of the things that they could bring up. There is a very low amount of metal because they had some metal when they were bringing up. They can't get any more. So as it breaks and goes away, they're losing a lot of their technology.
How is that?
I think it's coming from outside.
Okay. It's coming from outside the room.
Just a weird beeping.
For people who can't actually hear what we're talking about, there is a very, very quiet beeping sound that I think is coming from outside. Mm-hmm. It probably won't even show up.
We are 7 floors up, though, so if it's truck, I'm very impressed.
So one of the things I found that was really interesting is I can't think of many fantasy novels of any description that focus so much on food as being so central to the makeup of the world. Like, food will sometimes show up, like, people will eat and then poop. Well, usually they don't poop in the books, but they eat, right? Like,
there's poop in my books, too.
Oh, okay, so they're pooping. It presumably has to go somewhere. That's awesome.
Hi!
No, but, like, I know, like, we're saying kind of silly, but that's actually an important detail to how a world works. Like, a world like yours has to actually deal with waste management.
Yes.
Where
yes.
the hell does this stuff go? Like...
Also, very good question. They do have the group that I mentioned that is sort of in charge of preserving the culture has a very systemic method of waste management. The other towers in the city are more of the throw it down into the clouds and it goes away society because you can't see it anymore, so it's conveniently gone. If you are living up at the top of the tower, that's a very good place to be. If you are at the bottom of the tower, that's a really shitty place to be.
Pun intended.
Quite literally. And it is, if you look at some societies, you will see that in reverse sometimes, where the people in the high-rises are living with the least accommodations to health and sanitation and decent housing. While, you know, this is reversed. This is the ultimate in shit flows downstream. It's just shit flows down.
Yeah, although that is definitely something that has been historically a problem for humans.
Yes.
I was actually recently watching a documentary about the Bronte sisters, and I learned that this fascinating and horribly depressing story of all of their lives, which were short, and they were all outlived by their father, who was the parson of this village, Haworth, in northern England. And the parsonage is at the top of a hill, and from like the point that they arrived until many years later, there was a very severe death rate in that village where people would just get disease after disease, and cholera was a big
yep.
one. And to the point that, like, it was higher than most other towns and villages.
Jeez.
And even higher than the London death rate, like, per capita.
I'm going to bring in the ghost
and
map.
So, yeah, like, the ghost map is an amazing book. So eventually, like, public health and safety came in to examine what was happening, and it turned out that what was happening was that in this town, the water situation was that the well was at the top of the hill, and everything flowed right down through the cemetery, which was right below
oh,
the well.
No.
So basically, every time someone got sick and died, the water would flow right through those diseased
oh.
remains, and then down to the rest of the people, and that was their drinking supply.
Yes, that is really a bad setup for anything. I am fascinated by how communities work and how communities keep things organized like that, because that is a goal, is to not pollute your water source or your food source or anything else. And I actually know more about sewer history in the United States than I really should, but that is a topic for another time.
I totally get out of this stuff, so if this is your passion, feel free
to
talk about
it. It's not my passion, it's just I am a fourth generation engineer family. They have been in the country for a long time doing engineering, and one of my grandfathers was in charge of the cleanup of the Hudson from the upstate New York area. So he basically had to talk the, like, Kingston area and those parts of New York into getting sewers and into getting a water treatment plant so that it wouldn't just go straight into the Hudson.
Yeah, so you didn't have just a poop factory in the river.
It's
yeah.
it cleaned up the Hudson.
Yeah.
I mean, there are stories. So I have there's a guy named Reds Woolman who taught at, I believe, I'm going to get this wrong and I'm going to be in a lot of trouble, Harvard and then Johns Hopkins, and it pioneered public health and public hygiene in the United States. And my grandpa knew him, so they worked together on certain things, and it was just really cool. But
so basically, having all this background probably made you hyper aware of the problems that your society up in the clouds would face.
This is, and I have civil engineers, I have bridge building engineers. My sister is a naval architect and marine engineer who builds sailboats. I can't get this stuff wrong. I will get it from every direction. So it also means that I have been doing their proofreading on their science papers since I was 18 or 19. So I get it. You know, I got it at the dinner table. I got it. My dad was a hydrodynamic engineer, so he did a lot of the work on power plants and things like that.
Wow.
So inflow and outflow that's what was for dinner. It really sounds awful. I'm so sorry.
This is like the most unappetizing podcast.
Welcome to Cooking for Books. I told you I was the queen of double entendre.
That one's good. That one's so perfect. I love it.
But it was. It is something that I come by naturally, and when I started doing science writing, because I was a science and engineering writer for a long time, I could talk to these people and translate it into English without them having to slow down. So it turned out that I could do that very well, and while I wasn't working on my creative work as much, I was doing a lot of really intense science writing as a nonfiction book for a while, and that's why I love the Ghost Map, because it's just plain English.
So are you familiar with
I'm not familiar with the Ghost Map.
Oh, okay. This
so
is the best
why
thing.
Don't you explain it, because I think it's brilliant. Obviously, YouTube too.
Yes. Well, this is, again, cholera in England, and in London in particular, was just this thing that would arrive and kill everybody and then disappear. And they had no idea what it was, but at the time they thought it had to do with smell. And they thought it was an olfactory thing that would just sort of a miasma that would plague the community.
That's even more terrifying than the disease itself.
It was, and it affected particularly the poor communities much worse than it obviously affected the less poor communities, because there was interest in stopping it. Oh God, I didn't realize that though. It was an economic plague as much as it was anything else. And until one man came in and mapped all the places where people had been dying, literally just took pins and stuck it in a map. Everybody else had assumed that it was the miasma, and they would go in and they'd fumigate, or they'd do all these ineffectual treatments until somebody, and this is where information architect, because he just said, okay, this person died here, and this person died here, and he made a map of ghosts, which is why it's called the Ghost Map. And he realized that the epicenter of all of these things, much like Julia's story when she was talking about the Brontes and the parsonage with running through the cemetery, were these pumps.
At the time, if you lived in London, all your water would come from your local neighborhood water pump, and you'd go down to the water pump and pump your water and take it back to your house and drink it.
Yeah.
And, one of the things that I find the most fascinating about it, the best anecdote of the whole book to me, is that there was this one point where he found this woman who died that was from a very wealthy neighborhood and wasn't near any of the other people who died. And so it was like, well, that seems to have blown that water pump theory to hell, because, nobody else drinking from her water pump is dead. But it turned out that she had grown up in one of the other neighborhoods, and that neighborhood was known for its sweet drinking water. And, sweet, pure, clear water. And she had gone, her son or someone had gone to the well to bring her the sweet, pure drinking water from her childhood neighborhood. And that was the infected area.
Oh, man.
And so she died.
That one, I remember that quite clearly. The other cool thing that he found out was that certain people didn't get sick in these communities, but it hit children and women particularly hard. And he realized part of it was because there were a lot of people who were not drinking the water, they were drinking the beer.
Yes,
from the local pub.
Especially if they were men who worked in breweries where they were paid partly in beer.
Yep.
So if you worked and your work was hauling big barrels or whatever, then you were getting paid in some ale or beer, and that was actually not infected.
For somebody who really likes how things are connected, the Ghost Map is one of those brilliant aha moments that just one person had that made a difference in the lives and health of everybody on the planet.
It's also
really, and he had to sell
a
it
super
for
fun
days.
Read. It's a fun, fast read. It's a very, even though it's a historical book and an educational book in a lot of ways,
and nonfiction,
it's not a dry, dull book. It's a very gripping, sort of whoa, what is happening here?
Yeah.
Does
exactly.
it talk about? I imagine it doesn't talk about. But one of the things is on the subject of London and dead bodies
and shit shows.
Yeah, related. One of the interesting things, I and I had a thing about it, but there's a book about...
I'd like to say hi to my editor.
But in London, all these people died, so they had to put the bodies somewhere.
Yes.
And when they went to go build the undergrounds, they would run into walls of bones.
Yes.
Yep.
And they in some cases had to, just go around them, because trying to dig through and take all of the bones out and figure out what the hell to do with them was so much. And it's fascinating when you look at the pictures. Because it's literally, you'll see the trains go like this, and there's this wall, and it's like, boom, it's just like, almost like concrete, but bones.
Where communities put their dead and how they treat their dead is really fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Where do your people put their
dead? Bonaire, how do they treat their dead? Well, that's part of the story.
Oh, so can't give it away.
It is a very... And how they treat not just their dead, but people who are blind, because they're living up above the clouds, there's a lot of vision problems. You get something called sky blind, which is cataracts. Mm. Because
you're too close to the sun.
There's glare problems and things. They're also, because gravity is a real problem for these people, there are lots of people who have injuries, and this is a culture that climbs ladders to get up and down, or they fly. They make their own wings to fly from tower to tower, or they walk from bridge to bridge. And they walk the bridges that take them from tower to tower, but the central group is the one who decides who gets the bridges. And they do that to keep the structure of the city together, but the others for power. Because if you're not connected to your neighbors by a bridge, then only the people who can fly can go and do trades and make connections. If you are injured, unable to fly, unable to see properly, then you are a weak link in the community. And for most people, they have family to help them up, but the towers tend to leave people below and treat them as unlucky because of, you can't help yourself climb up, so why, there are some people who will not speak to it directly, but they are desperately uncomfortable with it, and the group that is in the charge of helping the culture rise thinks about those people very differently, and it's actually a very redeeming quality for them that they find things for their differently abled people to do. So there is a bit of conversation in this book about disability, but it's not a huge theme. It will play out later on in the series if we get that far, which I hope we do.
Okay, so this first book, when is it actually scheduled to come out?
It's coming out in May 2015.
So we have a whole year to wait.
You have a whole year to wait.
But I know in the meantime you have some other things that you have either already out or coming out soon. Can you tell us about some of those?
I do. I have a story coming out in BCS, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, which is called, I want to get this right, The Topaz Marquise, which is one of the Jeweled Valley stories. It's the first of the Jeweled Valley stories to come out, and this is about a jeweler who comes across a very bad gem, and things happen. Scott Andrews is an amazing editor to work with, and he saw sort of where I was headed with this, and just how I just really got into how I can make it stronger, and I'm thrilled. I can't wait to share this story with everybody. I read it at PhilCon, and it was a packed room, and it was just a great experience to get to see everybody just like watch all the pennies drop. So that's coming out. I have a very, very short story coming out in the Lakeside Circus, which is it's tinier than Flash, and it is about global exploration in Victorian times and lies, damn lies. I have a story coming out in Daily Science Fiction sometime soon about future food and love. It's called Nine Dishes on the Cusp of Love.
So,
and I was going to talk about the
food stuff.
That I have two food stories. One that hasn't sold yet, and the Nine Dishes story is a little bit scary. It's actually the weirdest. This story was rated "You Scare Me" by my husband. So he finished reading it. He's like, I don't know what to do with that, but I'm going to go sleep on the couch. And then the story that is out this month is a story in Asimov's, which is a straight science fiction story. It is about a colonization team that has been rotated in to a moon to or an exoplanet, actually. They've been rotated in to help with the terraforming, but also to take all of the ore out of this place before the settlers come in. So they're basically doing the prep work, and they are all at least the group that is doing most of the work is actually in the brig from the military. They're serving their time by working it off for a corporate concern that has leased them for a period of time. And one of the problems that you get in the military, especially when a project is winding down, is you get a lot of boredom. And you get a lot of people who have a lot of time on their hands. And in this particular community, they have a character who is very big into making dares and taking bets. And the community has gotten into some things. They are traveling with a technology that allows them to sense things like minerals and also air quality so that they can know when they can take the dome off and have the area be ready. Instead of using circuit-based sensor technology, they are using modified WASPs because WASPs have very, very sensitive antenna, and they can sense different scents. You can train, and this is actually true, you can actually train WASPs to scent for particular things by putting the scent up against a filter, letting them smell it, and then putting some sugar water up against it. And then the next time they smell the scent, they will associate with the sugar water and come towards it. And so that motion can be tracked, and you can basically make a visual circuit with it. So
that is incredible.
Yeah, so that story is called like a wasp to the tongue.
Yeah, I saw that. It comes out in April, the April edition of SL.
It's out now. Yeah, it's out right
but
now.
But it's March.
It's yeah. Asimov's released the April May edition I think 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, Asimov's and F and SF both released earlier.
Oh, okay.
Than
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So and that was a
so
little
that thing. Should be on newsstands now.
Yeah.
All right. I will go get it when I get home. I will go.
Oh great! Yeah, I'd love to hear what you thought of it.
Yeah, I'll hunt it down. I may actually just buy the ebook because the Barnes & Noble closed in my town. So
now
I've got one bookstore in all of the town.
Asimov takes subscriptions, too.
I know. I should probably try. But in any case, okay, because we're running a little short, and I want to make sure we get so everybody knows where to find
you. I would love to come back. You guys are a lot of
fun. Well, yeah, like when your book comes out, we'll have to have you on again.
Yes,
we
contact
you. We've had a chance to read it.
Yeah.
So before we go, where can people find you and your work?
Well, I have a blog, Cooking the Books, and a lot of links to the free fiction that is available available off of links from franwild.net and franwild, FranWilde at .wordpress.com. And I'm also on Twitter, Fran_Wild, and all over the social media. And I love to talk to people who like to read both science fiction and fantasy.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on
for
our show.
For this very colorful interview.
Yes, we did talk about some rather racy subjects, as I said.
I don't know if I would call it racy.
Maybe not that word.
I feel like that gets into territory I don't want.
Sure. Okay. Maybe just... No, I was
yeah, no.
Escape, I was
there's
like, no,
there's no way you're gonna save yourself. Let's just get a
logical
ending.
Oh gosh, yes, that's great for my first podcast.
All right, well, everybody, go check out Fran's website. Go check out the cooking books stuff, which there's a whole bunch you've already mentioned. You mentioned a whole bunch of them in this.
There
episode.
Are 23 interviews so far, and I'm always I do more every month. So
that'll be great. And on that note, I'm just gonna say awkward ending. And scene. Done.
What a shitty interview.
Oh, puns. Puns again.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, we have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog too you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service. If you like it, you keep it, which is cool. And that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.